Good evening. If we could take a seat, we'll get the meeting started here. We're privileged to have Dr. Sarfetti here all the way from Atlanta. And I'm going to introduce him in a minute. But let me just open up in a word of prayer first. Father, we come to you just to ask you just to bless this time. We thank you for each one that is here. We pray that they would be blessed what they hear through Dr. Sarfetti. We just thank you for his ministry and that of Christian Ministries International, and we just pray that you would use them mightily tonight. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So just a word of introduction first. I represent the Apologetics Forum, and we have monthly meetings up in Arlington, and then when we have a speaker out of town, like Dr. Sarfetti, we bring him to about six or seven different churches. Last night he was in Lacey, and at a pretty sizable church there, and we had a great turnout here. Not quite as much as this, but pretty close. And so we have two sets of tables back there. On the left is the Apologetics Forum, and so we have a lot of resources that you can avail yourself of. And then on the right is the Christian Ministries International table, and then CMI is for short, and they have a lot of different resources too. Dr. Sarfetti will mention a few of them as he goes through his talk. So this is a flyer in the back you can pick up if you don't know what we do. And if you're not on our mailing list, there's a sign-up sheet on the back that you can take a look at and sign up with your name and email, and you'll be informed of what is coming up. Also, some of you may have seen this already, but there's a sheet is back there as well with Sarfetti's complete schedule. He's already spoken last night and tonight, and tomorrow night he's going to speak up in Arlington. And I'm not going to go over all the topics that he's going to be covering, but I do want to mention that Saturday, he's going to be doing a mini conference, and there's a flyer on that on the back table as well. He's going to be talking about Genesis and the evidence of the flood for the truth of Genesis, and also Jurassic reality, talking about dinos and how they fit into Genesis and the Bible. And then Sarfetti has another skill that some people may not know about. He is actually, as you'll see later, he's not from here. He's from New Zealand, and he was a chess master there, and I believe a national champion in chess in New Zealand. But now he's here, but he still does his chess. Last time he was here, we had him up in Mount Vernon at Evangel Baptist Church there, and he had 38 people on different chess boards around the table in a loop, and he played them all. So if you want to be challenged, Saturday afternoon from 1 o'clock to 4, he's going to be playing whoever signs up. You can sign up online on our website, apologeticsforum.org. And if that's not enough, we're also going to have him do a special youth night in Arlington at Atonement Free Church, and that's listed on here as well. And so we invite youth to come and hear him speak on it's on answering skeptics. You know, how do we answer skeptics? And so, and then Sunday he's at two other different churches. So we keep him pretty busy. So with that, let me introduce Jonathan. Jonathan is a PhD in physical chemistry, and that was in New Zealand and maybe Australia too, but I think it's all New Zealand. And most of his time has been spent in ministry with Christian Ministries International. We have one other speaker from Christian Ministries International. That's Dr. Rob Carter, who is one of his colleagues, and they are both well-advanced scientists, and they can answer a lot of questions when we get into Q&A time. So, Jonathan, come on up.
Oh, thank you. Nice to see a good crowd on a wet Thursday night, isn't it? So thanks for all of you for coming. Now, just to reinforce what was just said there, I am a real PhD scientist. And if you want to know what I did, I used to shine lasers onto selenium ring molecules and cage molecules. Look at the scattered light, and the difference between the scattered light and the laser frequency would tell me how strong the molecular bonding forces are. That's what I was doing, to investigate the molecular bonding forces using lasers. I'm a person that some people say doesn't exist. That's a scientist who believes the Bible. And it shouldn't surprise you, because science actually grew up in a Christian worldview in the European Middle Ages. That's the foundation. Most of the founders of modern science were Bible-believing creationists. I mean, you think of Sir Isaac Newton, the greatest scientist who ever lived, probably, and yet he wrote more about the Bible than he wrote about science. He thought his most important work was on a commentary on Daniel. So, and for instance, even today, a lot of you might have had an MRI. Well, the inventor of MRI was a Bible-believing creationist, Raymond Damadian. Now, another thing, I don't come from this country, as you probably know by now. I actually am a dual national, New Zealand and Australia. I was born in Australia, did my schooling in New Zealand, went back to Australia to work for Creation Ministries, but now I moved over here, so here's a geography lesson for you. I've been here since 2010 with the U.S. branch of Creation Ministries. I became a U.S. citizen in 2019. Okay. One reason we moved over here is because we have two little granddaughters who live in Florida, which is only 500 miles drive from us, which is easier than 9,000 miles across the ocean. Okay, so I am a chess master. So sometimes I would play like this. Here I'm playing these guys here. I'm playing 12 guys here. I'm here. And this guy is telling me what they're doing, because every square has a letter and a number, like an Excel spreadsheet, so he can tell me what they're doing, and I'll tell him what move to make for me. Okay, that's what I'm doing there. I'm not playing blindfold tomorrow, though. I'll have to look at the boards. Now, another thing, I'm ethnically Jewish. My name is the Hebrew word for Frenchman, so I can tell Jewish jokes and French jokes and get away with it. Now, we actually have an interesting book called HaMashiach, which is about how Jesus fulfilled the prophecies in his first coming of the Old Testament, which is the Hebrew Bible or the Tanakh. And some of those prophecies have an expiration date on, so only he could have fulfilled them. And of course, a lot of my time these days is spent dealing with this man. You may have heard of him. Okay, he's probably undermined the Christian faith more than anyone else, which is why we have this huge dropout rate from church youth group. And as we found out, we actually did a video I'll be talking about a bit later, an interview with students, and we found that the students who are no longer going to church never got any creation teaching in their church. They never were taught how to answer the evolutionary propaganda you get in the schools and the newspaper, the media, Hollywood. But the ones who were taught, they could actually handle the evolution they got in university, and they're the ones who are still going to church. So what we say, what we do makes a difference. And one way to make a difference for everyone is our free website. Take notes if you can't remember websites very easily. Our website is creation.com. And it has about 15,000 articles on. In fact, I'm going to give you permission to use your cell phone in church. You can actually sign up for a free email newsletter, which will connect you to our website and tell you what some articles coming up. Like, for instance, they might discover the latest missing link, and you're getting questions from your colleagues and your schoolmates and family. What about this missing link? The Bible must be wrong. And we'll have an article about that very soon. But always think, well, hang on, didn't they find the missing link last year and the year before that? What's happened to those? They don't tell you they don't believe them anymore. I mean, most of the missing links I learned at school, they don't believe those are missing links anymore. And other things we have. And also, what we're going to do is actually have the sign-up sheet's going to come around. I'll let them, you know what to do. First, your email and your name. But one thing, we promise not to spam you or to sell or give your address to any third party. We protect your privacy, okay? But you want to put your name and your email and your postcode, because what this postcode will do means if a creation speaker is coming into your general area, we'll tell you about it if you want to go and see the speaker. So do you want to pass the clipboards around, guys, please? Thanks for your patience. (Clears throat) Now, I'm doing a very specialist talk, but what we are trying to do with this specialist talk is to help you be ready to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give a reason for the hope that's in you. I'm hoping by now you realize the Christian faith is not a blind faith, but we're supposed to be prepared to give reasons and answers for what you believe. And Jesus said the greatest command was to love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, strength, and your mind. There's nothing in the Bible about checking your brains in at the church door. But even got commands about renewing your mind. But what happens are your kids come home from school and they ask a parent, if God made everything, who made God? And dinosaurs died out millions of years ago. The Bible must be wrong. And carbon dating proves billions of years. And how do we get different races if we came from Adam and Eve? And where did Cain get his wife when he wasn't able? And these are found in this book, the Creation Answers book, which I think, yeah, I'm going to give you guys a chance to ask me questions in a Q&A time. And in my experience, a lot of the questions that come up are actually in this book. There's 60 or so questions and 20 chapters. And this is part of our starter pack, which has my first book, Refuting Evolution, which is an introduction for high school students, how to address the evolution in their high school textbooks. And also there's a free DVD there, so it's a real Jewish bargain. And another book you might like is called The Genesis Account. It's a commentary I wrote called an 800-page commentary on Genesis 1 to 11. It's the only commentary in the world that discusses dinosaurs and design of cells, but also talks about what does Genesis mean and how the doctrines of Christianity had their beginnings in the early chapters of Genesis and how Jesus and the apostles understood Genesis. So that covers a lot of ground in 800 pages. But I want to show you why this is such an issue. Now, you may have heard of Richard Dawkins, leading atheist evolutionist from Oxford University, but he says biology is a study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. But of course, I think that's because they were designed for a purpose. That's the appearance is actually reflecting reality. He doesn't believe that. But the Apostle Paul tells us the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so they are without excuse. Even Dawkins and Darwin have no excuse. So I want to go through how we know something's been designed. Like I know you guys have a very impressive aeroplane museum, Boeing museum around these parts, right? Yeah, so the thing is, if you didn't see the Boeing factory, you would see an aeroplane, you'd know it was designed, but how would you know the aeroplane was designed, do you think? Well, for one thing, you'd notice loads of correct components, but an aeroplane's made up totally of non-flying parts. Well, does the cockpit fly? Does the fuselage fly? Does the wing fly? Does the tailplane fly? Well, how do I get back to Australia? Use high-speed rail like some of your politicians suggest? Well, the answer is they are organized correctly. So correct components, but also correct organization, and organization requires an organizer. This is what we know from experience. Now, I'm going to contrast this with the evolutionary view of our organization. Evolution can be summed up with three things. Matter plus time plus energy produces organization. Very easy to understand. I'm going to test this theory now. Matter plus time plus energy. I'm going to have matter in the form of a junkyard of aeroplane parts. I've got a tornado to provide the energy. And as much time as you want, and you eventually end up with an aeroplane. So how realistic is this? Not terribly. Now, what if I told you, I've mislabeled the picture here. What I'm showing you here is actually the tornado hitting the aeroplane and turning it into a junkyard. Does that sound better? Yeah. Why? But why does it happen? Well, okay, the reason it happens is that there are many more ways of being a junkyard than being an aeroplane. So when you have time and energy, you go to the more probable state, which is the junkyard. I mean, do you know why, for instance, if you've tossed a lot of coins, you get a roughly 50 mixture of heads and of tails, right? See, there's only one way you can get all heads or all tails, but many ways you can get 50-50. Okay, that's why you're more likely to get a 50-50 than all tails. Another example, do you parents have to tell your children to mess up their rooms? Once again, it's because there are many more ways of being messy than being tidy. So children are sort of a form of energy, you might say, in time. Yeah. Now let's apply this to living things. You see, living things are much more complicated than any man-made thing because living things can make copies of themselves. Now, the Boeing jumbo jet doesn't have a baby jet. The Boeing factory will produce jets, but it won't produce a baby factory. But see, your children are sort of copies of you. Now, when you go even deeper, your body is made up of trillions of cells, and your cells are constantly making copies of themselves, which is how your body grows and repairs itself. If you want a few facts and figures here, a 70-kilogram man has about 30 trillion human cells and about 40 trillion bacterial cells. Most of them are large intestine. They do you some good. They're actually good for you. And about 400 trillion viruses. You see, most bacteria and viruses are good for you. You don't hear that, do you? That's why, I mean, God would have created all of them good for us, but now some of them are not so good for us, as we know. But they're all originally good for us, and most still are good for us, okay? But that's a bit of some facts and figures for you. But the thing is, all these cells have the ability to copy themselves. So they're far more complicated than any man-made machine. So how did the first living thing arise? Well, I'm going to do another experiment with matter and time and energy, but this time it's a frog and a blender. And I'm going to add some energy by turning the switch on. And the result's a frog smoothie, right? Now, if I left this going for millions of years, do you expect a frog to hop out of here again? And once again, the principle is there are many more ways of being a smoothie than being a frog. But do you realize if I could can and sterilize this mixture, it would be safe to eat for years. And that's the principle of canned food. If it doesn't have to be smoothie, of course, you can be a Georgia peaches, Florida oranges, okay, canned sardines. The principle's the same, though. Even though you have all the chemicals and components and cells of living things, if you've sterilized and sealed it, you're not going to get living things growing in there to give you food poisoning. Your food poisoning is caused by germs, bacteria. But they're living things. They're not going to arise in there. Even though you've got an ideal mixture of chemicals and components, far more than any sort of primordial soup could possibly give you. But, I mean, apply whatever energy source you want. Anything you want. In fact, choose any mixture of chemicals you want. You're never going to get life arising from that. Unless the seal got broken and it came in from outside. This is a very important principle. Real science says life comes only from life. Evolution says life once came from non-living chemicals, but whenever you eat canned food and don't get food poisoning, you should realize evolution doesn't have a leg to stand on. And this was discovered by creationists like Pasteur and Lister. You see, antiseptic surgery is an incredibly life-saving invention because Pasteur and Lister realized that germs were not forming by themselves. They had to come from outside. So Lister decided to get an antiseptic spray to prevent the germs coming into the wound. Because before that, surgery was as dangerous as the thing it was trying to treat because of the high infection risk. And Lister got rid of that by understanding real science, which is contrary to evolutionary science. Evolution is an anti-science position. Now let's look at a few of these things. Now, just to show you some of the amazing things of living cells, how amazingly complicated they are. One thing is the energy. You see, I know you eat food for energy. But in the cell, the energy is this stuff here called ATP. It looks complicated. It's not really that complicated. But you see, your body makes its own weight in ATP every day and consumes it. Now, cyanide kills you by stopping this being made. So it's very important stuff. But now we know it's made by the tiniest motor in the universe.
Music. This animated sequence shows the ATP synthase enzyme in operation. The animation is based on an incredible series of scientific discoveries. Only the colors show artistic license. ATP, or adenosine triphosphate, is the energy currency of the cell. ATP is produced by a tiny molecular rotary motor, rotating at up to 7,000 RPM. These are so small that 100,000 would fit side by side in a millimeter. A current of protons drives the motor, unlike man-made electric motors, which use electrons. This portion of the enzyme is where adenosine diphosphate is combined with a phosphate ion in the presence of a catalyst to produce ATP, which is then released, making way for the next cycle. A top view of the enzyme shows the sequential operation. Almost every biochemical process in your body requires ATP. Such a nanomachine exhibits all the characteristics of super-intelligent design. ATP is vital for life, and many of these motors were needed before the first living cell could exist. An evolutionary impossibility.
So every one of your trillions of cells has thousands of these motors whirring all the time. You'd be dead if they weren't working. Now, I just want to point out another interesting point to make is when it comes to knowing design, think about the airplane there. What would really clinch it as a design thing is finding the instruction manual to build it. And this is what we actually have in living things. We have not only the machines, we have the instruction manual, which is the famous DNA molecule, which stands for definitely no accident. With deoxyribonucleic acid. Now, this is actually a very, the design is actually, for me as a chemist, is that the design is good. Now, acid, now, I don't know how much chemistry you know, but acid is something that gives off a proton, a hydrogen ion, and what's left behind is called the conjugate base, which is negatively charged. It gives off positive. And so the DNA is actually negatively charged, which provides an electrical force field to repel certain chemical attacking molecules. So the fact that it's an acid is actually a very good design, but also it means it can actually wrap around things which are proteins that are positively charged in your cells. So that even the acid part of it is a design feature. But what the DNA does, it has four different types of letters. You see how the letters match each other, which means that it actually is a, like a positive, like a photographic negative. A always matches with T and C with G. So it means that the instructions can be copied from parent to child. See, people say that you got your mother's eyes or your father's ears. Well, no, you didn't really. You got the instructions from your mother's eyes and your father's ears. And it was copied on the DNA when the two halves of your mother and father came together to as fertilized egg. That's the beginning of life, according to science. It's not a religious claim that life begins at fertilization. This is science. And when the DNA comes together, a new person is born with the instructions from both mother and father. It's because of this amazing, intricate interworking of these chemicals that you can see. It's a nice geometric pattern there. Now, the thing is, we have amazing amounts of information, instructions. See, even the simplest living cell, it's called a mycoplasma, has about 600 kilobytes of information. But the data compression must be amazing because they try to work out what happens when the cell divides into, makes a copy of itself, and they try to model it on computers. They needed over 100 computers running together for 9 to 10 hours to model what happens when this thing divides. So it produces about half a gigabyte of information when it divides. So what sort of data compression software is going on is really mind-boggling. But this is the sort of simplest thing. In fact, it's so simple, it probably couldn't exist on its own. It's actually a parasite. It has to get certain things from other creatures that are more complicated. So this something like this could not have been the first life because there's nothing to live on. Okay? And by the way, viruses aren't really living things. They have to hijack reproductive machinery from another cell. They haven't got the reproductive machinery themselves, just the code that gets copied. They need to hijack them, copying machines of other cells. But bacteria have their own reproductive machinery. Now, this is the simplest cell. And I want to show you what happens when I'm talking about how DNA works. I mean, and it gives you an idea of what, how things are going. Like for instance, DNA is a string of letters. You've got this first dimension, one-dimensional code, but also in two dimensions and three dimensions, how, in fact, it has the instructions to organize itself in three dimensions. See, what happens if you've got a cell for your eye? You want the eye information to be accessible. In fact, your eye cells all have bone information. But the bone, you don't want a bone poking out of your eye socket. So the bone information is actually turned off and also buried deeply, so you're not going to touch it. So the DNA actually has the instructions so to where to put the information. So it's in another dimension, but also even you can talk about four-dimensional genome because it refers, it could actually encode for the timing. So things are expressed at the right time as well. Okay, so that's part of it. But then, as I said, DNA is involved with copying. But in fact, DNA can't copy itself. It needs a whole lot of machines before the instructions can be copied to the next generation. I want to show you what happens when DNA is copied.
Using computer animation based on molecular research, we are now able to see how DNA is actually copied in living cells. You are looking at an assembly line of amazing miniature biochemical machines that are pulling apart the DNA double helix and cranking out a copy of each strand. The DNA to be copied enters the production line from bottom left. The whirling blue molecular machine is called helicase. It spins the DNA as fast as a jet engine as it unwinds the double helix into two strands. One strand is copied continuously and can be seen spooling off to the right. Things are not so simple for the other strand because it must be copied backwards. It is drawn out repeatedly in loops and copied one section at a time. The end result is two new DNA molecules.
And this is only part of the amazing machines that are needed. This is for even the simplest life has to have all this machinery, otherwise it wouldn't be life. It wouldn't be able to copy itself. And one interesting problem for evolutionists is that DNA has the instructions for its own copying machines, but you can't copy those instructions unless you already have copying machines. And the, another thing is the copying must be incredibly accurate. I mean, for instance, if you've got a DNA that needs to be copied that's a million letters, really only one mistake in a million is allowed. Because what happens if you have more than that, it's going to introduce mistakes into the next copying machine, which will do a worse job of copying and therefore introduce even more mistakes. And it won't take long before the copying machine's got too many mistakes to operate. This is called error catastrophe, and it actually goes back to Genesis 1, where you remember God said everything was very good. Seven times he said it was good, and seven is a number of perfection in the Bible, and the seventh time it's very good. And here we see scientific support of that, that things had to start very good. They couldn't work up to being very good because they wouldn't work at all. They had to start very good. Now what we're seeing is degeneration, thanks to the fall of Adam. Now we're seeing degeneration from that perfection. But it had to have started off basically perfect, otherwise it couldn't work at all. Now one machine that's been omitted from this picture is something to do with what DNA is like. Now DNA, I mean, if you took one of your cells, took the DNA out, and put it end to end, it would be about 2 meters long. Or about 6 feet or so, right? Okay. That's from one cell. But it's only a few nanometers thick, and it's a coil. So it's actually a very awkward sort of molecule, really. I mean, think about it. Some of you guys are old enough to remember landlines, right, with the telephone coils and how they got coiled up. Okay, I remember them too. I'm not that young, I suppose. That's a problem for DNA, being a really incredibly long and coily thing. And why doesn't it get tangled up? And it will get tangled up, but the cell, living things have machines to avoid it. I'll show you what's going on here.
Let's consider what happens as DNA unwinds during replication. As DNA unwinds, it acts like this rope when we pull apart its two strands. As you pull the strands apart, twisting tension builds up in the rest of the coiled portion. It is actually adding one twist to the remaining rope for each twist pulled out of it. At some point, you can't separate the strands anymore. The remaining rope is too tightly twisted. If you relax your tension on the rope, it will twist around itself in a supercoil. It is releasing tension. If you want to keep pulling the rope apart, you have to release the tension periodically. And one way to do this is to cut the rope and splice it back together. This problem has been best characterized in small circular DNAs. There are two methods of dealing with this problem in DNA. One cuts only one strand of the DNA double helix, and the other cuts both strands. Let's look at the first. Topoisomerase 1 enzymes cut a single strand of the double helix, pass the other strand through the cut, and reseal the break, relaxing the overwound molecule, which now has one fewer twist. Topoisomerase 2 enzymes do the same thing, but with both strands of the double helix. Topoisomerase 2 cuts both strands of a double-stranded DNA and passes another double strand through the break and then reseals the break. So if a molecule of DNA is supercoiled, topoisomerase 2 can remove the supercoiling, two twists at a time, to yield a relaxed circle.
So this is, again, something which is essential for living things. But again, trying to think about how you'd build it up slowly and gradually as evolution requires. Because this machine has to do three things or else it's going to do more harm than good. It has to chop, but it has to move, as well as splice it back together again. If it doesn't do all three, it could do a lot of harm. In fact, an antibiotic class called the fluoroquinolones works by stopping this topoisomerase 2 from putting the DNA back together again. So what happens to the bacterium? It's been got the antibiotic, and it slices the DNA to smithereens and doesn't put it back together again. So I mean, it's worse than useless if it doesn't do all the job it's supposed to do. Another thing, it's a very the instructions to build this enzyme here, this machine, are on the DNA, but you can't read those instructions unless you already have these machines to untangle while it's being read. So in fact, to build a topoisomerase, you must have these machines already operating to make sure the DNA doesn't get tangled up in the process of reading and decoding the instructions. So again, a very interesting machine here, and it had to be there right from the beginning. Bacteria have them, we have them. Now, I don't want to go back to DNA again, because as a chemical thing, I mentioned that it has some design features to make it more stable than it would be otherwise, but actually still a fairly unstable molecule. And here is one expert on it, that people think the DNA is rock solid, but in fact it's very reactive. On a good day, a million bases or letters of DNA in a cell are damaged. Now, humans have about 3 billion letters, well, letter pairs they are. Okay, so a million of those every day damage, you'll be a mutated mess really quickly. So the only reason you're not a mutated mess is because we have amazing machines to repair this damage. And this is the Nobel Prize for Chemistry was awarded for this issue in 2015. And see, with the first study, Tomas Lindahl, he showed that DNA, he's the first one to show that DNA was really, really unstable. And therefore, life really shouldn't be able to exist because DNA breaks down so quickly. So he realized there must be things that cells do to undo this chemical damage. And so he's motivated to look for these machines that would actually help to undo that. And the other people who awarded the prize found other machines to undo this chemical damage. But that's a problem for the origin of first life, because DNA is so unstable, you wouldn't expect it to arise in some sort of primordial soup because it breaks down too quickly. Now, there's a related molecule called RNA, but that breaks down about 100 times faster than DNA does. And yet, the most popular theory of origin of life, I'll be going into that, is called the RNA world. But see, what happens, here's a difference. Deoxy means removing an oxygen. So here's ribose, it's got the oxygen and hydrogen. D Deoxy means you're removing the oxygen. So it actually makes this a bit more stable because the oxygen is quite reactive. And what happens is that the RNA actually cleaves itself. It breaks itself apart. That's why RNA has to be stored well below freezing under liquid air, basically, or dry ice at least. Probably liquid nitrogen is better because it's just so unstable. And it's interesting when you see, here is one expert on the origin of life, and he says that the RNA world, it's an interesting, the RNA world hypothesis, the worst theory of the early evolution of life, except for all the others. So they're admitting they haven't really got a good theory of life from non-living chemicals, but they're committed to materialism, so they've got to believe that life came from non-living chemicals despite the science. Despite the problem that RNA is complex, is unstable, and it doesn't do what they claim it should do. But to get back to this issue here about the DNA, so it was just like DNA is 100 times more stable than RNA, but still pretty unstable. But what happens when they find DNA in dinosaur bones, as they have done? The T-Rex and also a Hyperoptosaurus had DNA. They're finding it quite often, more than they think. And the thing is, how do they find DNA? There's certain chemical tests that everyone knows about, all the biochemists use. One's called DAPI, and what that does, it lodges in the minor groove of the double helix. So it actually gives off a fluorescent signal. It's a very distinctive signal. It says, we've got double helical DNA there. Which probably means at least 12 letters. So to form a double helix, you've got to have DNA bonded to each other to form a double helix, okay? So it's picking up double helical DNA in dinosaur bones that are said to be 68 million years old. But then we've actually got figures of how fast DNA breaks down. You can measure it in a chemistry lab, and you've got certain chemical laws that will tell you at different temperatures how fast this will break down. And this is the conclusion that they had. So I've got American degrees here and proper degrees here. Okay, so you can get an idea. So below freezing, minus 5 Celsius, 23 Fahrenheit, the maximum survival time before it's totally broken up into individual letters is about 6.8 million years. That's the maximum when it's deep frozen. And yet they claim a dinosaur is 10 times older than that, and it's still got intact DNA in it. And they also say dinosaurs lived in warm climates. And since they're warm, the DNA goes up, the instability is far greater. Things break down. In fact, it's a literally exponential dependence on temperature. So by the time you get up to, say, it's not very warm. I mean, I wouldn't say 77 Fahrenheit is that warm, is it? But then the maximum survival is about 22,000 years. In fact, when I've looked at the figures, and what they've observed seems to link up with the dinosaurs being about 4,500 years old, buried during the flood. And that evidence is consistent with the sort of DNA that's been found there. But millions of years, forget about it. So this all not just has a issue for design, but also for the age of the universe, which they want to tell you is millions of years old, billions of years old, but the fact DNA shows it can't be that old. Now, I want to also go through now about, see, humans have about 3 gigabytes of information, so about 5,000 times more than the mycoplasma. Okay, and if the DNA information in each of your cells was written out into paper and ink, it would be about 1,000 Bible-sized books of information. But only about 200 times the size of the IRS tax code. Now think about a book here. See, the book is written with ink molecules on paper. But the information clearly did not come from the ink. Okay? The information clearly came from outside the ink. You need an author to arrange the letters into words and sentences and paragraphs. Okay, it didn't come from the ink. Even though it rides upon the ink, it doesn't come from the ink. In fact, one thing you can't do to find out what a book says is to put it in my spectroscopy lab. It's totally the wrong, it's a total category mistake to try to analyze a book by looking at the chemistry of the ink. It's totally irrelevant to it. Now, in exactly the same way, there's nothing in the chemistry of the DNA to make it write out the letters, the instructions of life. Again, the instructions are riding upon the DNA chemistry, but don't come from the DNA. Any more than the instructions of a book come from the ink molecules. Now, another thing is that a book doesn't mean much to you unless you understand the language it's written in. My books are written in English. Like, for instance, if I give you a gift, okay, that's something you'd like me to give you, right? Because it's something you get for free. G-I-F-T means something for free. I don't know why people say free gift, because that's a pleonasm, because a gift is free by definition, isn't it? But if you're Germans or Dutchmen, would you like me to give you a gift? What does it mean in German then? It means poison in German, yes. Yeah. In fact, a German I met in New Zealand, I was giving creation talks, my parents live there. He confirmed I was right, that gift in German means poison. And he said when he first came to New Zealand, he was appalled by our Christmas custom because we try to poison our families. So you see, it's very important to have the right language. But in fact, it goes even further than that, because my books are written only in one language, but your cells actually have multiple languages on the same part of a DNA. When you think about a book, it requires clearly human intelligence, at least human-level intelligence, to write a book in one language. But what about a book you write and you could read in German and English and backwards and every 10th letter? That would require superhuman intelligence to write a book like that. This is what we actually have in living things. We actually have multiple languages on the same part of the DNA. And this is actually where the so-called junk DNA comes in. They were looking at only one language and thinking that this DNA was junk, it didn't do anything. But they found that it was actually doing stuff. It's all doing stuff. And it's involved with these other languages. So the whole idea of junk DNA belongs in the junk pile. Another example of how evolution is an anti-science idea. It actually discouraged work in finding out what this other DNA was doing. By dismissing it as junk, you're anti-science, holding back the process of science. So I want to show you how one of the languages works. And again, this requires loads of machinery to point to do that.
This animation demonstrates how the digital information encoded within DNA is used to direct protein synthesis. This is a DNA double helix containing the digital code which directs the cell in all aspects of operation. And here we see a protein complex called an RNA polymerase traveling down the DNA strand. As it moves down the strand, it carefully unwinds the DNA, preparing it for transcription. Inside the polymerase, we see a single-stranded copy of the original instructions being assembled as individual bases are positioned and added to the growing strand. A stop code marks the end of the protein specification, at which point this copy, known as a messenger RNA transcript, exits the polymerase and heads towards a two-part chemical manufacturing machine called the ribosome. While the messenger RNA moves towards the ribosome, transfer RNA molecules attached to specific amino acids in preparation for assembly. As the messenger RNA transcript passes through the ribosome, the process of translation begins. Using the instructions encoded on the messenger RNA as a template, the transfer RNA molecules align specific sequences of bases to corresponding amino acids, creating a protein chain. As this chain exits the ribosome, it is met by chaperones which prevent premature folding, while escorting the protein to a barrel-shaped machine called a chaperonin. This machine helps fold the protein into the precise shape required to perform its function. Although it is unclear how the chaperonin achieves this, we do know that accurate folding is essential in order for the protein to accomplish its intended function. Once the protein is complete, it is released into the cytoplasm to do its job.
So again, all these machines have to be working pretty much all and basically perfectly, otherwise life could not exist. In fact, you have an idea of how each one of those is a vital part of living things just by looking at the way antibiotics work. Antibiotics target one of these machines, and that's enough to kill the cell. I mentioned the fluoroquinolones targeting those detangling machines. Now, the thing's oligomycin targets that first motor I showed you, binds that first motor. Okay, you've got something called, it's a penicillin class. What they do is they knock holes in the cell wall, and the bacterium basically disintegrates with a cell hole in the cell wall. And you've got another one called streptomycin, that binds that ribosome I showed you. Tetracyclines, they stop the chain from growing in the ribosome. So all these different things, they attack different parts of this process. And just one of those things disabled is enough to kill the bacterium. Now, here's yet another thing, as I mentioned before, that DNA has the instructions for its own decoding machines. But to read those instructions, you must have decoding machines already there. And going back to the ATP motor, the ATP is made by motors, but to build the motors, you need the instructions in the DNA, read by decoding machines, which use energy, which is ATP, made by those motors. So it's not just a chicken and egg problem, it's like an egg nymph grasshopper problem, a three-way circle. In fact, this is the simple version. Here's the complex version that Dr. Robert Carter drew. Okay, of all the interconnections to make this ATP motor, all the different things that have to be working. That's the more complicated version. And just to show you some other interesting things about DNA, DNA is the most compact information storage system in the entire universe. For instance, I don't see many computers which have more than 2 terabyte hard drives, right? Or now you have solid-state drives. But a pinhead of DNA has about 2 million times the information capacity of your 2 terabyte hard drive. Just one pinhead. So in fact, DNA is in fact the ultimate information storage system in terms of compactness, because it stores the information basically in three dimensions, as it does. There's a limit to how compact you can get information, because it's determined by the size of, we're getting down to the size of the atoms themselves. And this is such an important thing that living things have by far the most important, the most compact and compressed information storage system we know. And this is important for things like how do we get the proteins, because the proteins of living things have to be very well designed to do the job they do. Like one thing you may have heard of is enzyme. I mean, hungry enzymes in laundry detergents or whatever it is. But enzymes are very specific proteins that speed up reactions that would otherwise occur too slowly for life to work. And they have to be very well designed to actually match the shape of whatever molecule it's trying to work on. In fact, one reaction sped up by 10th the power of 18 times, one followed by 18 noughts, or zeros, as you say here, right? So it means it would take 78 million years in water without this enzyme. There's another one which is 1,000 times faster still, so you've got a reaction that occurs in 1/100 of a second, so it's suitable for life, but without this enzyme, it would take 1 trillion years. So you've got to, again, this is a problem. I'm going to show you how one enzyme works. Just to show you how finely tuned everything must be to do what it does.
To understand how enzymes work, let's take a closer look at a reaction in the citric acid cycle that is catalyzed by the enzyme aconitase. Aconitase binds to its substrate citrate and removes a hydroxyl group and a hydrogen atom to form the intermediate cis-aconitate. It then adds the hydrogen and hydroxyl back in slightly different positions to form the product isocitrate. In the active site, some amino acids are perfectly positioned to recognize the substrate and hold it in the optimal position for the reaction to begin. Some amino acids are involved in recognizing and holding the substrate. Other amino acids are directly involved in catalysis. Histidine 101 acts as an acid by donating its proton. Thanks to the chemical environment of serine 642, it can act as a base by accepting the proton from the substrate.
The active site of aconitase also contains an iron sulfur cluster that stabilizes the substrate electrostatically and helps to position it relative to the catalytic residues. The first step in the reaction is dehydration. In this step, histidine acts as an acid and protonates the hydroxyl on the substrate, allowing it to leave as a water molecule. Serine then acts as a base, extracting a hydrogen atom from the opposite side of the substrate, forming the intermediate cisaconitate. Cisaconitate then flips upside down, and the complementary hydration reaction is performed. In this step, histidine grabs a hydrogen atom from a passing water molecule, placing the resulting hydroxyl group back onto the substrate. Serine then returns its hydrogen atom, and the final product isocitrate is released. Notice that the enzyme itself was not changed by the reaction. It extracted a hydroxyl group and a hydrogen atom, and then put them back, thus starting and ending in the same state. This is the hallmark of a catalyst. When it finishes a reaction, it is ready for the next, so it can perform thousands of reactions in a row. Notice also that the shape of an active site is often flexible. Many enzymes surround their substrates, enclosing them to form the perfect environment for a reaction. Enzymes are fundamental to life on Earth, working every second of every day to maintain life processes in every cell, in every living creature on the planet.
Well, see, even if you didn't get the chemistry here, I hope you got the idea at least how the enzyme must be tuned. It's atomic level precision tuning of the shape of the enzyme to do what it did. Otherwise, it couldn't do it. And that requires this fine tuning of the DNA instructions to build that enzyme. And it's only been recently with advanced artificial intelligence they've actually worked out how you can go from a sequence of DNA to work out how the protein is going to be shaped. It took decades to work out how you could actually go from the sequence to the shape. And of course, living things do that all the time. And just why I mentioned this issue of everything going on here, this is actually a very powerful argument for the God of the Bible. I want to, first of all, point out how natural selection can't help in this process. Here is one of the leading evolutionists from the last century. He said, natural selection is differential reproduction. Now, that means this thing is fitter than this thing, therefore this thing leaves more offspring. Okay, so what do you need for natural selection to work? You must have reproduction. Therefore, natural selection can't explain the origin of the first reproducing cells. With all the stuff I've shown you, that's what you need for a self-reproducing cell. And natural selection cannot help you here until you have reproduction. Because he said pre-biological natural selection is a contradiction in terms. And this is what actually helped Anthony Flew, who is the leading atheist philosopher for decades, but just before he died, he became a believer in a creator, unfortunately not a Christian, because of the sort of evidence I've been presenting. He says that Richard Dawkins overlooks the fact that Darwin's pointed out that his whole argument began with a being which already possessed reproductive powers. And this is the creature, the evolution of which a truly comprehensive theory of evolution must give some account. Darwin was aware he had not produced such an account. It seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. That's what I'm hoping that, I hope I've shown you some interesting things, but I also want it to be useful in sharing the gospel, how the gospel makes sense of this. The God of the Bible makes sense of everything I've been saying here. And just to show you that there are some blind spots to people, like here is one of the leading enzyme experts who's an evolutionist. He says, without catalysts, and enzymes are catalysts, remember, there'd be no life at all from microbes to humans. It makes you wonder how natural selection operated in such a way as to produce a protein that got off the ground as a primitive catalyst in such an extraordinarily slow reaction, like the... Remember the reaction I mentioned here? These reactions, which are so slow in water. He said, well, how would you get this happening? But that's clearly wrong, because if these enzymes are essential for life, you can't resort to natural selection. You can't have natural selection unless you already have these enzymes. So it's a curious blind spot. What he claims here doesn't make any sense. And that's, I think, what happens when materialism, I think it dulls the brain, actually. Because it's not that difficult to understand. And that's a problem, that the idea of life coming from non-living chemicals is accepted by faith and not by science. And this is one late information theorist who said that research on the origin of life from non-living chemicals seems to be unique and that the conclusion has already been accepted. And what remains to be done is find the scenarios. And he later on, he just says that contrary to the received wisdom, describing the genesis of life on earth by chance and natural causes, which can be accepted on the basis of fact and not faith, has yet to be written. And he made the same thing 40 years later. Okay, so he hasn't changed his mind there. So this is the sort of thing I've been talking about, why this is a powerful argument against the evolutionary dogma, and also, as I mentioned, against the evolutionary timescale. The fact that we find DNA in dinosaurs is a very powerful evidence against the evolutionary timescale. So just to conclude here, the origin of information is a huge problem for evolution, and Richard Dawkins was asked about this. He said, if I can get this going... Oh, never mind, it doesn't seem to work. It doesn't want to work for me. I'll fix that later. Dawkins also said evolution has been observed. It's just that it hasn't been observed while it's happening. And he said that Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. He needs evolution as a crutch for his atheistic faith. And so what are we supposed to do about it? Well, the Bible tells us, demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive thought, every thought, to make it obedient to Christ. See, I'm hoping that what I'm saying is not just about showing evolution is wrong or proving some sort of intelligent designer of who we don't know the identity of. I want to point people to Jesus Christ, who is our creator and our savior. That's what I want to do with these meetings. This is why I do what I do. And this is one reason we also bring these resources to people, because I know you can't remember everything you hear in a one hour talk, and I can't cover everything in 1 hour either. I mean, later on Saturday, I've got a whole talk just on the flood. I think on Saturday night, I've got a whole talk just on answering the so-called new atheists. Okay, I've got a whole talk just on the history of Genesis and why Genesis is a history. So a lot I could discover, but if you're thinking, you can't make up your mind what book to get or what resource, I would suggest you get this one. It's a glossy magazine that's attractive, people will read. It comes out 4 times a year to feed you and your family with information. This is probably the number one resource to get, and it is the number one witnessing tool we have, because here is a case of someone who has given our creation magazine, because it gets given away, or people read it because they want to read it. And again, it undermined his evolutionary excuses. He realized there must be a creator God, which means if he created me, he owns me and has the right to make the rules for me. I've clearly not obeyed the rules. So how could I become right with my creator? And so every magazine presents the gospel. And here's another one about how it actually is a family equipping tool, not for just for her, but also to teach her children something you're not going to get in the government schools. And let's face it, it's not a case of whether to witness to your children, but who is doing the witnessing. Make no mistake, people are witnessing to your children, whether you like it or not. So let's give them the right sort of witnessing, which is why we have a chance to subscribe. And there's some clipboards going to come round here, which look a bit like this. And what you can do, don't pass just yet, okay? You've got a choice of a 1 year or a 2 year. But 2 years is sort of bulk buying discount. But also... And don't forget, what you do when you get this, just to let you know, is to put your name so we know who is subscribing, your address so we know where to send it, and important, your email, because you get a free digital subscription, which means we'll send you a code and you can give it to people around the world, family, friends around the world, not just the country, and they can put it on, and they can read it on their digital devices while you have the hard copy for yourself. And we also, don't forget, when you get this thing, you've got to, don't go away, please take it to Barry at the book table and you can get some gifts, which are English gifts, not German gifts. So go ahead and pass, guys. Thanks for your patience. Now, if you pay for 1 year, you get your first, this is the, what we've got on the table is actually the current issue. We have the current issue on the table, and again, you get the digital version, which you can share with people. If you get a 2 year, it's even better, though, because not only the bulk divine discount, but you also get this DVD called The Voyage That Shook the World. It's an on-location look at Darwin's voyage. You're going shooting at the Galapagos Islands in Argentina, then going back to where he lived and where he grew up and where he lived for the rest of his life in England, showing those houses, but also what made him tick, what was his background that made him think the way he did, and what's wrong with it. Well, how can we refute that? And also what we have in this one is very interesting, because here is where we ask students from an American university, are they going to church? Were they raised in church? Are they still going to church? And if so, were they ever taught evolution? Do they have answers to their evolutionary indoctrination? And it's interesting that the ones who got creation teaching in their church and their home, they're the ones who could actually withstand the evolutionary indoctrination. I mean, we're trying to get people interested in having us talk to their church. And, well, we don't need you guys. We believe this already. Okay, but do your children believe it? And can you defend what you believe? And if you haven't, for other months, you've got various things coming out to you. We've got some nice updates and things. Just to give you an idea of an article, here's one of the articles, a classic one, which is called How Dating Methods Work. It's not about how boys meet girls. It's about how old things are. And there's an interesting fountain in Yorkshire, in the north of England, that's so rich in minerals that it will turn teddy bears into stone. But anything you put in there, any cloth will soak the mineral and be turned into stone. And every issue has an interview with a Bible-believing PhD scientist, which here's Steve Austin, who's done work at Mount St. Helens, which is in this state, I believe, right? As well as the Grand Canyon. And we also have examples of design of things. In fact, one of the my favorite things about design is how human engineers are copying the designs of nature. They're finding things there that they never even thought of before. Like, for instance, evolutionists dismiss dragonflies as being primitive. But now engineers are trying to make flapping air vehicles by modeling on the way the dragonfly flies. And also the dragonfly has a brain the size of a pinhead, but it has some amazing computer software that it can track an insect, and the insect doesn't realize it's being followed. It actually follows the insect in such a way that it isn't detectable. And so they're trying to work out how can we do that for stealth fighters? But it would need a big computer to do that, not a brain the size of a pinhead. And every magazine has a children's section. I'm actually writing the kids' section for a 12-part series over 3 years on astronomy and things like, you know, the solar system and stars and various planets and extrasolar planets. So I'm doing a few things. That's my topic here. Here's my little niece reading there. Well, actually, she's about to have her a baby of her own, okay? This is an old picture. Yes, kids eventually grow up, I'm afraid, yeah. And if you want to, there are some other kids. We've got a whole lot of new kids' materials at the back. There's several kids' dinosaur book, as well as Exploring Dinosaurs Amidst the Head, which is actually a more advanced book. It looks like a kid's book, but it's really a book that the whole family can enjoy, actually. That's the sort of book we can have there. And also, if you want a video, you can't make up your mind what video to get, I'd get this one, Evolution's Achilles Heel, 15 PhD scientists and amazing graphic quality with this one, as well as why does it matter, like how evolution led to the Holocaust, for instance. We actually have a clip of a Nazi propaganda film saying we have sinned grievously against natural selection by allowing handicapped people to live. And this is a new sort of curriculum book here, Question of Origins. But now it might be a good time to have a question, or go into a question time. Is that right for you? Are you guys having to go into a question time? And the only rule I have is that what you say has to end in a question mark. Okay, so do you want to ask me some questions? I'll try my best to answer them on all sorts of different topics, okay?
Yeah, so if you have a question, put your hand up, and I'll bring the microphone around so people can hear it.
Yeah. Don't let go of it, please.
Thank you for this. If Darwin was alive today and came up with his wonderful hypothesis, how would he be treated knowing everything that, like you just presented? Would he be laughed out?
Well, it's an interesting thing you asked there, because actually on the Darwin Bicentennial, my colleague in Australia, Dr. Don Batson, who's a PhD biologist, he wrote an article called Would Darwin Be a Darwinist Today? And he goes into all the ways that Darwin has been proven wrong by real science. But then he concludes, yes, he would be a Darwinist, because he needs Darwin to justify his rejection of the biblical God. He did not want to have Christianity being true. Very much detested the God of the Bible. So we think because of his worldview, he would have had to adopt something like Darwinism today, despite the scientific evidence, not because of the scientific evidence. So that's an article. It's on our website, creation.com. You can look up the Would Darwin Be a Darwinist Today? It's an interesting question. Please, go ahead.
Yeah.
If in the Bible, Noah was commanded to bring one of every species, male, female, then how does that explain the extinction of dinosaurs if they were one of every species and they were in the boat?
First of all, when you say that they're in a boat, I mean, when you look at what sort of boat we're talking about, I think it's important to understand how big it was. It wasn't this silly thing here. Please, it wasn't this. Because the Bible tells us how big the boat was. Yeah, here's a cubit. Elbow to fingertip is a cubit, okay? If you want a bit of trivia here, cubit is the Latin word for elbow. If you have a blood draw from here, it's called the cubital fossa. Okay? So 300 cubits, say 18 inches is a typical cubit. Mine's about 19 inches, but 18 inches, let's say 18 inches for a cubit. What does it amount to? That amounts to a boat longer than a football field. And it's wider than six lanes of the interstate and taller than a four-story building. So it's not just a tiny little boat there. It's an enormous vessel. It's an ocean liner. I calculate my Genesis commentary, and also there's a video series called the Genesis Academy, which you might be interested in, which is based on the Genesis account, but it's actually speakers from four different countries. The Genesis Academy is a 12-part video series which is good for your Sunday school and homeschool to teach about Genesis. Now, I calculate that the ark's volume is about 340 times the capacity of a semi-trailer. So it's a pretty enormous vessel. Okay, so see how tiny people and, in fact, how tiny these enormous trucks are by comparison with the ark. So when you say boat, I think you need to know it's actually a very large boat, and also a very stable boat, so stable that waves about 500 feet high could not capsize it. And also the dimension is such that the passenger would not get seasick either. So a lot of different things. Now, also, the question assumed one of every species. No, that's not true. One of every kind is what happened. The kind is much bigger than the species. And as we know from today, these two creatures are the same species, actually. They can interbreed, even though it's artificial. If you found them in the fossil record, you'd probably say they were different families. Okay, so when you talk about how many kinds, in fact, when you look at things like this, how many species are here? There's only one kind here because they can interbreed. The tiger and the lion can form a liger. If it's a male lion, if it's a male tiger, it's called a tigon. Okay, so when you look at some of the hybrids there, you see ligers. This is a kama, which is camel and llama. Okay. Beefalo, which is basically buffalo. Okay, another one. Zonkey, zebra, donkey. Okay, zorse, guess what that is? Geep, goat and sheep. Pig and boar, what do you call that? Paw? I don't know. Pizzly, grizzly and polar bear. Could be a growler bear, I suppose, if it's a male grizzly, right? Wolfin. It's a false killer whale and a bottlenose dolphin, which are members of different genera, not just different species, but different genera. And they can interbreed and form this wolf. And the wolfin actually has babies of her own. So it's actually, they're actually the same biological species because they actually have a fertile hybrid, but they're called different genera. So when you talk about kinds and species, you've got to realize sometimes they're much broader than what you might think. And sometimes our man-made classification have basically split things which should be members of the same kind. So what we're saying here, now when you apply it to dinosaurs, it's likely that the ceratopsians, which are the dinosaurs with the horns, they're basically probably one basic kind with different head ornaments. That's why how an evolutionist described them. Or you have maybe 50 or so different dinosaur kinds. Okay, so only one of 50 pairs there, okay? And so look at the sauropods. The sauropods are the ones which are really big, right? These are really big dinosaurs, the sauropods. And how many kinds are there? When you look at the skulls, I have to say that these skulls are probably the same kind of creature, don't you think? They're called different genera. Genera is a rank higher than species. And yet, I think they're the same kind of creature. The Apatosaurus is very massive, but not quite so long. Or the Diplodocus is long and slender, but the same kind. Then we have the issue of dinosaurs changing shape when they grow. And it looks like these three dinosaurs have been given different genera, different genus names, but they're the same creature. The Dracorex, the Hogwarts, the Harry Potter dinosaur is basically a baby. This is sort of a teenager, and the Pachycephalosaurus is the adult version. They're the same kind, though. And in fact, Jack Horner, who's an atheist evolutionist, said that about a third of dinosaur species may not have existed, but are different stages in the growth of other known dinosaurs. Another example, the Torosaurus seems to be a mature version of a Triceratops. So when you think about how many kinds there are probably not that many kinds of dinosaurs. Maybe, 50, 100 dinosaurs on board the Ark. Also, who said the dinosaurs had to be fully grown? Dinosaurs started off life as eggs. No bigger than a football. There's a limit to how big the egg can be because of it. See, eggs are porous. They have to let oxygen through. So the growing baby doesn't suffocate. But the bigger the egg, the thicker the shell has to be to support the weight. They go get too thick, and it's too thick to let oxygen through. So the physics limits the size of the egg. Also, looking at growth rings on dinosaur bones, every dinosaur discovered has the same sort of growth pattern. So when you think of the Apatosaurus, one of the really big dinosaurs, okay, fully grown, maybe 25 or 30 tons, but when he's 4 years old, he's only one ton. So since God is the one who brought the animals to Noah, why wouldn't he just pick a dinosaur that's 4 years old and only one ton? A year later, he hasn't grown that much. But as soon as he gets off the ark, he zooms up to full height in only a few years. I mean, 5.5 tons per year of growth, that's pretty big. Okay, that's what I think. That's why I don't see the problem, how big the ark was huge. There weren't that many kinds of dinosaurs, and they probably weren't very big when they went on board the ark. Okay, so I think this covers it. And by the way, remember I mentioned this book right at the beginning, the Creation Answers book? There's a chapter here on dinosaurs and a chapter here on how do the animals fit on the ark. So see how useful this book is? Okay, question.
Questions? Yeah. When you described the way an antibiotic interferes in the bacteria reproduction, is it doing that to our cells at the same time? Only the bacteria?
If it's prescribed to you, they've got to make sure it doesn't do that to your cell. It's a good question, but I think if you're given it, they've already made sure it doesn't do that to your cell because our machines are designed differently from bacterial machines. So it means it probably won't interact with our machines and only with the bacterial machines because they don't want to give you something that will hurt you. They want to give you something that will cure you. And therefore, something is actually designed for the bacterial system and not to our system. They are quite different. But it's a fair question to ask, and I don't blame you for being curious about that.
More questions?
Is the latest drugs that we have for COVID-19... Mm-hmm. Does it affect that DNA any at all?
The drugs, you mean? What mean the like? Well, see, the COVID is actually an RNA RNA virus. Okay, so what? I think one of the best drugs the newest drug is something called Paxlovid, which interferes with a protein involved that the virus has, and it's a specific viral protein. And it seems the trials for Paxlovid show it's about 89% effective in preventing serious disease if you take it within the 3 days of diagnosis. Other drugs, it's hard to know what they would. So the cheap drug, a cheap steroid called dexamethasone, which is actually about 30% effective at preventing, at helping severe disease from getting worse. And also an antidepressant called fluvoxamine, which is about 30-something percent as well. But what that seems to do is actually, they seem to be helping with your body's response to the virus. Because what happens, the virus gets you, your immune system can overreact. And that can produce a cytokine storm, which can actually inflame and damage lung tissue and other organs. So a cytokine storm often is the killer complication. And these drugs seem to calm down those cytokine storms, which is why they can be very effective. Like when you think of the flu pandemic, the so-called Spanish flu, misnamed Spanish flu, just around the time of the end of World War I, that was actually very nasty to younger, fitter people because the H1 influenza actually caused very severe cytokine storms, and younger people had stronger immune systems, so their cytokine storms were more intense. And that's why it actually was very dangerous to younger people, the Spanish flu. COVID seems to be more dangerous to older people, but I think it's still the cytokine storm is a major complication, and these cheap drugs that I mentioned seem to calm that down. Okay. Is that sort of a question you're asking? I'm not sure. But it's an RNA virus, so the other antivirals, what they do is they induce mutations. Because mutation, there are many more ways of a mutation making something worse than making something better. So some antivirals make the virus mutate too much, and again causes the error catastrophe. So that's what mutation will normally do. So some of the antivirals work by producing lots of mutations in the virus. Okay.
More questions?
RNA was not stable?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a very unstable molecule for sure, yeah. Well, you remember that show, that video I showed you? Remember that one about DNA, protein, and all that? Okay, it goes DNA to RNA to protein. It doesn't go RNA to DNA. See, what the RNA vaccine does, it goes into your ribosome and makes the spike protein in a special cell called the dendritic cell, and that exposes that to the immune system, which then reacts to that and trains itself to react to the same thing on the virus. But it cannot touch your DNA, because again, it goes backwards, as I showed you in that video. The DNA is read, remember that machine that goes along the thing and produces messenger RNA, and that actually goes into ribosome, and that's made into a protein. It doesn't go the other way around. So the RNA vaccine cannot hurt your DNA. It cannot alter your genes. It's just not the way it works. That's not, as I hope I showed you in that video. Oh yeah, I'm not at all defending some of the things that have been said by the government. I'm not supporting government mandates or anything like that. I'm not, my issue is the science, okay?
Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, back to the Noah's every kind. So the dinosaurs got on the boat, we know that.
Yeah.
How did they go extinct? Was it the environment or?
That's a very interesting question. Like, in fact, I've written a book on dinosaurs, co-authored with Joel Tay from my office. It's being laid out as I speak, and we cover a few examples of what could have possibly caused the extinction. Now, let's face it, evolutionists don't really know how dinosaurs went extinct either. They've got all sorts of weird theories about how it happened. I'll go through a few of them. in history. Like, one was the junkie theory, which said that narcotic plants evolved, and then the plant eaters got stoned, the meat eater then had nothing to hunt. Another one's called the constipation theory, which says that low roughage plants evolved, and again, the plant eaters first died, then the meat eaters had no prey left to hunt. The current one, main one, seems to be the asteroid or meteorite impact theory. Several things are wrong with that, though. Okay, one thing is, if you accept the dating, the millions of years, the scientists now, the evolutionary scientists, saying, well, a lot of dinosaurs already become extinct before the meteorite hit. If you look at the evolutionary dating of these things, which I don't necessarily believe, okay, so the meteorite could not have caused extinction of things that were already extinct before then. I mean, for instance, stegosaurs are supposed to have gone extinct millions of years before this, okay? Why, we don't know. But the other thing is, it seems to wipe out the wrong things. I mean, why would a crocodile survive? I mean, dinosaurs were meant to have ruled the Earth for 150 million years or so. And so why are they wiped out by the meteorite, but not the crocodile or the frog or the butterfly, which are probably more vulnerable, I would have thought, to the catastrophic climate change produced by the meteorite impact? So why were these powerful dinosaurs and these amazing reptiles in the sea and the air, why were they wiped out but not the frogs and the butterflies? And so we say that everyone has their own favorite mechanism. You can operate on your own intuition. And just to give you my favorite evolutionary view is the Gary Larson one, that tobacco evolved and they all died of lung cancer. But how did what did creationists think? Well, I think possibly if there were the environmental change after flood may have had a lot to do with it. I agree with that. Like, for instance, the cooling of the Earth during the Ice Age might have been bad for these large reptiles, whether in the sea, the air, or the land. So I think the post-flood Ice Age would have had something to do with it. And also, something that's come out, which is in our dinosaur book, for instance, dinosaurs would probably outcompete, the adult dinosaurs can outcompete the lions and all that, but could the baby ones outcompete? But you see, that's one theory for the extinction of the megalodon, the huge giant super shark, is that the juveniles could not compete with the adult great white sharks. Okay, so even though the adults would easily overpower a great white shark, the juvenile, they have to get to the adulthood first. They have to go through the juvenile stage, and if the juvenile can't compete, then the adult doesn't exist, doesn't get a chance to exist. And so I wonder if that's one of the things. But I also think humans would have hunted them too, being dangerous creatures. And humans could have beaten them both with fire and poisons and traps and barricades. I mean, think about the whales. Whales are bigger than dinosaurs, but humans almost hunted them to extinction. Even though whales are bigger, they have a bigger brain, more intelligent. They have the home turf advantage being in the sea. And yet humans almost wiped out the whales with wooden sailing ships and handheld harpoons. Okay, so I think that there wouldn't have been a problem humans hunting dinosaurs with the teamwork. Okay, so that's what I think probably happened as well, as humans killing. That's why we have dragon legends around the world, and they seem to always end with the humans killing the last one.
Okay, and I think we'll end the questions here, and let's thank Jonathan for the presentation and the Q&A. And he will be available at the table to catch them there, to ask some more questions that you might have of them. And he'll be available at the table to explain some of that, the resource that he has there. And, of course, at the apologetics table as well, we have Ron Payne in the back there who is going to take care of that. For the events that are coming up, I want to mention that tomorrow night, Friday night at 7 o'clock, is Atonement Free in Arlington. But if you're not able to make it there, it is live-streamed. So just go to the website, apologeticsforum.org, and you can see that at 7 o'clock. And then Saturday morning, also, the mini-conference starts at 9 o'clock for 3 hours. He's going to give two more lectures and an extensive Q&A. That will also be live-streamed on Saturday morning. The other events will not. So, again, there's a sign-up sheet for the Apologetics Forum if you want to get on our mailing list. And just look at the flyers and all kinds of information there. So let me just close in a word of prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Father, We come to you again just to thank you for Jonathan's ministry and that of Christian Ministries International. Thank you for all the information that they make available to us to learn about your creation. And Lord, we see that the creation that we see here agrees with your word, and we just thank you for the evidence that you have left for that. We pray that the talk this evening will result in people doing their own research and asking more questions and sharing what they've learned with others. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.